how many of you this morning would be willing to play Russian roulette with me? I don't think that there's very many in this audience, but still thousands of people every day, every month, every year are neglecting themselves by not having checkups. In this campaign, we, and you in particular, are here to be able to help your neighbors, to be able to help your friends. The idea of this particular campaign is not just to go out and collect money, but it's also the idea of giving them information on how they can protect themselves, how they can protect their lives. Do you realize that today there are 300,000 fatherless children because of cancer? From a personal aspect, a few years, I should say at 3 months, I was one of these. There are another 250,000 who are motherless because of cancer. But because of people like you, we are beginning to win. And this is our slogan this year for our campaign. We're beginning to win. I think this statement is well worth thinking about and repeating over and over in your mind as you go out today to start your solicitation. At the end of this program, we're going to be distributing the kits to the Crusaders or to the chairman who are going to be giving them to the Crusaders. And I'd just like to run through the kit very quickly with you because it explains itself very nicely and I don't think you'd have any problem. The kit this year is a nice small kit, again, that you can fit into your pocket. Right inside it is the instructions on how each Crusader should run his own particular crusade. You will have the cards, which indicate the people that you are calling on, which has the names and the addresses. It also has a stub on the back, which you can tear off as the receipt for these particular people. We have the why card that explains why we are having the campaign. And then, of course, the information that is so important to leave with every single person that you call on. The instructional information, the educational information that tells them about cancer and how they can watch out for it. This is the thing, even if they don't give you a penny, please leave one of these with them so that everyone that you call on has one of these in his home or his office after you have called on them today. We are attempting to run a blitz campaign again this year, which is today. We hopefully everyone when you leave here will get at your campaign, your individual campaign, just as quickly as possible. All of the monies that you have collected can be returned to either the cancer office or to any one of the Midwest federal offices. And if you have any trouble finding one of those, please call me. No. We don't have arrangements with them. Somebody wants to buy something quick. At the end of the program, I will discuss how we're going to distribute these kits. And if there are any questions, there will be a number of the campaign staff out at the tables, and we will answer these questions at this time. Our main speaker today certainly needs no introduction to the citizens of Minnesota, for he is well known and a great friend of Minnesota, the nation, and the world. Mr. Humphrey started his career as a professor in the University of Minnesota. He was elected mayor of Minneapolis and went on to the United States Senate, where he became a very influential world figure. During the previous administration, he served as vice president, the highest political position ever obtained by a Minnesotan. Mr. Humphrey is now a professor at the University of Minnesota and at McAllister College, where he's helping to develop the young minds of today. Ladies and gentlemen, Minnesota's number one national citizen, the Honorable Hubert Humphrey.
repeat what I said good morning. I think I should say to Dr. Barr and other members of the medical profession that are here, as well as my fellow citizens and friends, I'm a night man. You know, there are two kinds of people, day people and night people. And I really don't try to carry on any conversation with anybody before 10 o'clock in the morning. Mrs. Humphrey and I have been happily married for some 34 years, and I don't recall that we've really visited at all in the morning. I mean, she feeds me and gets me out and gets the monster out of the house, and then somewhere during the day, I start to come alive. I used to do most of my bipartisan politics before 10 o'clock in the morning, because that was always, I didn't have to worry too much about whether or not I was going to be unkind under those circumstances. Well, I want first to express my thanks to Fred, and to Mr. Dresser, to Rudy Boswich, and to others here that have permitted me to join this morning with the volunteers of our Cancer Society here from Hennepin County, and of course of our state organization. I'm very pleased to once again share a platform with one of my closest friends and one of the finest men of this community, Pastor Youngdahl. And I think we all know that we have a job to do, and you didn't come here to get any big, powerful message. If you did, I'm afraid that you got the wrong man to talk to you today. I frightened Fred a moment ago. I said, well, let's get going. I said, I got about an hour speech here I want to give to everybody, and he thought we ought to declare an emergency. I thought that's what was happening when that call came in here. Then I took a different view of it when I heard Rudy say that he said he felt like a politician. It's been so long since I felt that way, Rudy. I was going to talk to you about how that was, too. I've noted that it has been recalled that I started out around this community being a teacher, and I was over at McAllister College in the University of Minnesota. I want some of my Republican friends to know here, I hear people from time to time say, well, old Humphrey, he's had the whole circle now. He's been all the way around. That finishes him. I think I might tell you that this might be just the second life. You can't tell. Just a rebirth. So having now upset you this morning and injected all kinds of non sequiturs into this morning's gathering, let me just get down to business. I want to tell you why I'm here. Because ever since I've been old enough to know anything about medicine, to know anything about the human body, and to know anything about mankind, I've been interested in health. I have been blessed with a good deal of it myself, which is, by the way, the greatest blessing that you will ever get. Make no mistake about it. And if you're in public life, there is nothing like health. Health is even better than money, even though together, they're invincible, I might add. But there's an old saying from the Middle East that he who has life has hope, and he who has hope has everything. And the symbol, of course, of the Cancer Crusade is the sword of hope. And it is hope. It's the difference between being alive, in a sense, in the full meaning of life, and just being dead, even if you are walking around as a physical being. I want you to know that my family has been stricken with this dread disease. I lost a brother who was very dear to me, quickly, very rapidly, from cancer. I never seen a braver man in my life. The pain and the suffering that he went through, I'm sure that had he followed the advice, that he would have still been with us, because early detection maybe could have made the difference. I really believe that. But he was so busy, and like most of us, I'm sure was so filled with fear that it might be that he put it off. I just mention this to you because I don't think anybody appreciates any of these things until it hits you closely. It's got to come right at you. My father once told me that he said, you'll never know what it is, son, to be in sorrow until you have suffered great pain and grief and tragedy. And that's really what it amounts to. You can't really talk to people about anything meaningfully, unless you have in some way experienced it. I'll never forget on the day in June of 1964. Thank God it's almost 6 years ago now. I was the floor leader in the United States Senate for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We had been in debate since the 10th day of February, the longest filibuster in the history of the American Republic. And I can recall that when I was asked to take on that job of being floor leader, which means to manage the legislation, I was called to the White House by the president, who had been the majority leader of the Senate at that time. As you may recall, it was right after President Kennedy's death. President Johnson had come into the White House. And he said to me, "Hubert, I'm going to give you the toughest assignment of your life. But," he said, "I'm going to be very frank with you. I don't think you're going to make it, because I don't believe that you and your liberal friends have the stick-to-ity power to stay with it." He said, "You're always getting up and giving these emotional pleas to the country, but when it's right there for the real acid test, why, some of your folks leave you." And he said, "I'm afraid that you will not stay with it either, but you can win if you'll stick with it. And it means that you've got to be there 24 hours a day if need be until you win this fight. And you have to organize, you have to out-organize, and you have to know your business and never give up." Well, this was the test in many ways in my legislative career. We'd never broken a filibuster. 76 years. And civil rights legislation had little or no chance of passage. We had 290-some amendments. And we never dared break the debate off from the beginning, from the early part of February until the 26th day of June. And I recall that I never had the chance to even once leave the nation's capital. And only once during that entire period of time did we lack a quorum. And to lack a quorum, which means a sufficient number to do business, you have to start all over again under the rules of the Senate, which doubles your work. On the very day, on the last day, or the day before, we passed the bill. And I shall never forget it, I got a telephone call from my wife. And I had known that Robert had had a little growth on his neck. And he'd been going to Mankato State College. And we had talked about it at Christmas time. And I had said, "Robert, that seems to be enlarged a bit." And he said, "Well, I've had it checked, and it doesn't seem to be anything particular. It seems like it's a cyst, so to speak." And I said, "Well, I think you ought to double check it again, because it seems to have grown." So he said, "Well, as soon as school is out." So he went as soon as school was out, and he went to a very prominent surgeon in this great city, to whom we are ever indebted. And he had his test made, and he had some what we thought would be minor surgery. And Mother called me and said, "Dad, Bob has had his operation. He's over at St. Barnabas. And they've made a preliminary examination of the glands that were removed, and they appear to be malignant." Well, she said, "I'll call you back just a little later, sometime today, and they'll give us further information. You men and ladies here know what this meant." I was exhausted, to say the least, from literally hours and hours of attention to the debate, because we were then in session as much as 18 and 20 hours a day. And the majority leader, or the floor leader, didn't dare leave the floor 1 minute. And that's literally true. And when I got that call, it was as if somebody had struck me right between the eyes. I couldn't believe it on the one hand, and I was paralyzed, literally paralyzed. Here was my son, whom I loved much. Here he was, just finishing his college. Such an attractive, good-looking young man. And all at once, bang, down came the blow. Well, I had to go back to that Senate floor. I wanted to leave immediately. Not that I could do any good, but it's the immediate reaction of a parent. And I had to struggle with myself to know what to do. Were I to leave, I was the one man in that instance, if I can be immodest, that knew all of the amendments, that knew what had to be done, and could not afford to let that bill unravel, because once that they touched it, as I was told, that once that they draw blood on you, Hubert, those that want to defeat this legislation will be at it and tear it apart. You must never let them touch it. And we had to defeat every amendment, and there had to be organization to do it. And I can still remember those amendments being called up. And I can still remember that I stood there almost like a stone, my heart broken, wondering what to say and what to do, and yet knowing that we had to go through this battle. Well, the day passed, 2 days passed, and I called my son next day. And I said, well, Robert, you're going to be all right. And I talked to him, tried to give him a little pep talk, and I'll never forget what this boy said at that time. He said, Dad, he said, don't kid me. He said, you know what I have. And he said, I'm not going to be all right. And I just literally couldn't take it. Well, fortunately, because of medical care and early detection and early surgery, and because of the amazing skill of people in this community who were associated with our Mayo Clinic, with our university, with our cancer control system here in our medical association, this young man has gone for 6 years now without any recurrence, which, of course, you know, hallelujah. I used to, every year, but each year went by, I'd tick it off because I knew that he'd have to go get these checkups every 3 months, and then another checkup, and a little later, 6 months. And each year I'd say, how was it? And I'd call his doctor and check it out. And now when I know that it's the 6th year, and most of us know that if you can get by those 5 years after it, you have a fighting chance. Now I tell you this because it is important what you're going to do. You're going to maybe save a life. You are lifesavers this morning. And it is, as has been said from this platform, when you walk out and call at that door, you maybe not get a contribution, but you surely should. You ought not to walk away until you do get one. And if anybody wants to contribute to the National Committee of the Democratic Party, well, you can pick up that too. We're in a desperate situation. But don't solicit. I mean, don't solicit. But in all sincerity, I had to break this spell of attention for myself, if not for you. In all sincerity, when you go on out as a volunteer, you are in a very real sense like a public health officer. You're alerting that family to take care of themselves, to go get a checkup. We have the means here in this community. It isn't as if we're impoverished. It isn't as if we do not have the medical facilities. The Twin Cities have the greatest medical center of almost any area of the world. And we ought to have the highest degree of personal and public health in this community. So when you go there to make that call, wherever you are, and as you work with others of the thousands of volunteers that we have, just think of yourself today, in a sense, as a medical technician. Think of yourself as a great civil defense force. Because what good is it to have all the resources in the world, all the wealth, and all the prestige, and all the title, if you're going to be stricken and have no chance to even enjoy what could be the blessings of life? When I read in this, by the way, I want to compliment those who put this material together. It is so persuasive. Just think of this. 9 out of every 10 homes you visit will be affected by cancer. Every time I look at an audience, believe it or not, when I go out and I go out and do a lot of speaking, I look at them, I say, isn't it, just think of it, 1 out of 5 in that audience will be stricken and die from cancer. And when you take a look at the fact sheet, which you will have in your folders, and you find out, for example, that there will be 52 million cases of cancer in our country. More than 52 million Americans now living will eventually have cancer. 1 out of every 4, 2 out of every 3 families will be stricken with cancer. 9 out of every 10 houses that you visit affected with cancer. 960,000 Americans will be under medical treatment this year for cancer. 1 out of every 6 deaths for any cause in the United States from cancer. Thank God for what the American Cancer Society has been doing about smoking. Of course, now I get on my favorite kick. Boy, you ought to hear my family. I quit, you know. I mean, there's nothing like a reformed addict, you know. And I did this, however, I'm happy to tell you, in 1956. And I know that it has given me a new sense of health and well-being. I know that because, of course, I'm sympathetic with anybody that goes through this problem because it really was something. My wife once said to me, she said, "Why don't you just continue to smoke? You won't live as long, but we'll be happier, you know?" Because I was so mean and so miserable when I was kicking the habit, so to speak. But I'm not here to give you a preachment about it. I just simply say that you have such a message to tell, and it's all right here. It's all right in this little book. And may I just suggest to those of you that are so very practical, and we need to be practical, what we do here in this work, where the money goes. 37 cents out of every dollar that you collect goes to research. And there is no substitute for research. And by the way, we're making breakthroughs. I am a pharmacist. In case the things go really bad, I can always go back to selling those pills. Chemotherapy, particularly in leukemia and certain forms of leukemia, is coming through now. And this combination of surgery and chemotherapy, and what we've learned in terms of radioisotopes and other things, and what there's so much that's happened lately, so much more hope. I saw here a figure that I thought was very, very important to us, that there are 1.5 million people alive today who have, in a sense, been cured from cancer. And that's because you cared, or somebody ahead of you cared, because somebody was alerted soon enough. I remember when I was in the Senate, we had a group come on down to they have an organization, a society of people that have had cancer, that have been cured of their cancer through medical care. And they work to get funds. Now, we have public funds through the National Institutes of Health, public funds that are granted to great laboratories and universities and medical schools and eminent physicians and microbiologists and so forth across this country to do research work and the treatment of the many different forms of cancers. So much that we need to know. We know so little about the human cell. And of course, if we knew more, we'd possibly have the answer. But we're getting some breakthroughs. For the first time, we've been able to really dissect the cell, so to speak, to even create synthetic forms of life. We're beginning to get a breakthrough. Now, public funds for cancer research, my fellow Americans, have been cut. I think it's ridiculous, but they have been cut. And if that's the case, then private funds have to be increased. Because you cannot retreat in this war on disease. One of the greatest needs today in America is disease prevention, preventive medicine. It's possibly the one major effort that we need to make for the good of our economy as well as our bodies. American industry, the amount it has to pay because of sickness, the increase in the cost of goods because of sickness, the unbelievable loss of income to families because of sickness, of all the wastes in the world, none is greater than sickness. And every time we prevent a disease, every time that we are able to attack what are called the so-called incurables, it's not only that it gives us the blessings of health, which is, of course, the great blessing, but it also adds to our economy, it adds to our well-being. I want to compliment the Cancer Society on doing such an extraordinarily good job at such a little administrative cost. When I look to see that 37 cents of that dollar goes for research and only 4 cents goes to the National American Cancer Society, 21 cents for public education and awareness, and service to patients, 13 cents, professional education, training of more technicians, more medical personnel, 5 cents of that dollar. This is money well spent. So let's go on out now and try to do a job. One of the one of the characteristics or attributes of our country, and we ought to kind of always think about that these days, because there are plenty of people that are thinking about what's wrong with us, is the fact that we have a blending in this nation between public and private action. I think what has made this country really in part what it is the volunteer. My favorite political scientist, the one that I frequently quote, is not a contemporary. He was Alexis de Tocqueville in the early part of the 19th century, who knew more about America as a Frenchman in the early part of the 19th century than any contemporary American does in the last third of the 20th century. It's an amazing insight in the character of the American people. Many of our people today only look at what people do, not what people are. They don't get any insight into what the character of a people is. But de Tocqueville did, and he said that one characteristic of the American people is if there's a job to be done, they seem to have a way of getting together as individuals voluntarily to do it. Now, no other country on the face of the earth has that. There's all kinds of countries, all sorts of them, that have public medicine, public this, public that. But one of the things that we have preserved in this country, which I think has given character and given a sense of humanity and given a sense of personality, of intimacy, all of which is so vital to all of these great efforts in health and social welfare, is the fact that we've had voluntary organizations, volunteerism. And the fact that you're willing to go on out and contact people and ask for their help is within itself a commendable effort. Plus the fact you're going to learn a lot. You're going to meet some nice people. You're going to learn something about neighborhoods. You're going to learn something about families. You're going to learn something about your country. So gear up this morning. I didn't come here with any great big prepared speech. I just come here to tell you that the life you save may be your own. Could very well be right out of this meeting. Somebody may decide, I think I'll go have myself checked out. And you should. You don't want to get in an airplane that isn't checked out. Why do you want to get in a body that isn't? You like to make sure that the maintenance out here in the aircraft is pretty good. Why don't you go and make sure that the maintenance of body, of health amongst our fellow citizens is very good? We're going to do it ourselves. We don't need to be directed. We don't need to have compulsion. We don't need to have somebody order us to line us up, to queue us up, to go get a physical. We can go out and just ask people to exercise that degree of self-discipline and self-respect. And be sure you get the check. I've spent a lot of my life trying to get people to do things they ought to do, including myself. I have more trouble with myself than I do with you. But I thought it was very clever this morning that when you get a check, people don't like to write checks for 50 cents. They will write one for a dollar. And if you see somebody that looks full of compassion, don't hesitate to give them a chance to exercise it, to use it by helping out. Because our goal is close to, what is it, 900,000 or more. And we need it. And we need it desperately. So, soldiers of health, forward march. Go to the battle.